Operation Pluto was to get the U.S. to nuke Cairo. I've heard this story from one source, but does that make any sense? You mentioned the fighters or bombers going out with nukes. Now that makes as much sense as the Israeli saying they were shelled by 50 caliber, 50 miles offshore. What good would a nuke do except to, it would never be used for anything except Cairo, but does that not kind of fit like a puzzle piece that if that your colleague hadn't gotten that message out, the story would have been that you were sunk by Egypt, our adversary. Does that kind of, I see you nod, so that would be what my point would be.
I'm not going to say negative things to Ingrid's theory. My focus is to get the real story of what took place on the river in the history. It's been so mishandled, misconstrued, and as I was discussing at dinner, I even had a high school sophomore in Brasovia a few weeks ago tell me that one of her teachers had been told that the reason the Israelis attacked us was we were carrying nuclear weapons to the Middle East. And there's been so much off-the-wall stories that all I want to do is give the real story of what took place. If you can watch this and realize how long they were under attack and the damage you've done and everything, and you can still say it's a case you've taken out here, then you come to a different place. But on the other hand, yes, there are people who, people who believe in false life that we were sent there by our own government on purpose to be sunk so it could be accepted in the war on the side of the Israelis. Personally, I don't buy into that, but that is, I'm not going to sit here and say it's not true either. I don't know, and you know what? I'm not really concerned about that. I just want the story of what really took place. I want our crew to be honored for what we did. And the one thing I can say that I have a problem with about the Victor Water related to the fact that the first plane coming off at the 6th Fleet were carrying nuclear weapons and they were headed for Cairo. I have a bit of a problem with that because I happen to know Joe Foley, Captain of the Senate Telegram, personally. And as I said in my presentation, Joe was looking at me as a confused look, and he told me he put 16 points in the airport, thank you for the time.
Oh, sure. I was going to nuke. I sent the nukes to Putin. Yeah, I'm sure your personal acquaintance would admit all of this.
Absolutely not. Because at that point, President Johnson and I and Dean Rusk had fully
drew the conclusion that it was a green light.
Absolutely not. Because at that point,
he said, no, you go home, your place is there now. I drew the conclusion that it was a green light.
Absolutely not. Because at that point, President Johnson and I and Dean Rusk had fully agreed that we must keep the U.S. in a position where if Israel called on us for military assistance to turn back the attack by Egypt and possibly turn back an attack by Egypt with the support of the Soviet Union, we had to be in a position that we could obtain the support of the American people and the Congress for applying military force in support of Israel. And we would not have that support if Israel had attacked Egypt. So our position was no. Don't initiate the attack. And I have no basis for believing that the Israeli you spoke of received any other indication from me than that.
That same night, a young NSA linguist named Alan Blue was suddenly dispatched to join the Liberty.
He was called in the middle of the night, around 2 o'clock in the morning. and he left the house. He went to NSA, and at noon the next day, he was on a plane to Rota, Spain. I'd never seen him that way. He was almost teary. He clung to me like he didn't when he had taken prior trips.
Alan Blue met the ship at the Spanish port of Rota. By now, the crew had been told they were heading for the Gaza Strip.
We knew that from the daily news that the Arab-Israeli situation was getting more and more hostile. That so far there was no war, but it looked to anybody who read the newspapers that there would soon be a war, and so we were sent out there, obviously, to listen to what was going on.
Early on the morning of Monday, the 5th of June, Israel went to war. Its planes pounded airfields in Sinai and the Suez Canal Zone, destroying most of Egypt's air force.
These are the original shots taken by the gun cameras during the attacks on the Arab airfields.
The fact is that they didn't have a clue when we came on. They were completely caught by surprise. They were having breakfast, or immediately after breakfast, some coffee, and boof, up we came on 9 airfields, 2 in the Sinai, 5 in Egypt, and 2 in Upper Egypt. And then we had the second round, and the third round, and the fourth round.
Once again, the actual aerial combat shots taken by the Israeli gun cameras.
Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was boosting its military presence near the war zone. It moved 20 warships into the eastern Mediterranean. In response, the Pentagon ordered the 6th Fleet to keep all aircraft and ships at least 100 miles away from the coast. But one vessel received no such message. The USS Liberty steamed on towards the Sinai coast.
We were told there was no need to worry. We had asked Commander 6th Fleet for an armed guard to go along with us, a destroyer. He sent the message back saying we were in international waters, flying the American ensign, there was no need for an armed escort.
The Liberty was approaching a scene of total Israeli victory. On the third day of the war, they'd taken the West Bank. But the big prize was the capture of Jerusalem's old city.
I was elated when I heard it. Jerusalem, every Jew prays, I think, every day next year in Jerusalem.
That evening, the Liberty arrived at her destination, off the Sinai coast. Thursday, the 8th of June, dawned fine and clear. But the war was still raging, and Israeli planes flew out from the Sinai Peninsula to check on the Liberty.
Reveille was at 6. You got up, you showered and everything, and you go for a chow. But before that, we had heard that, like at 5 in the morning, or around that time, that the planes were buzzing us.
The Israeli aircraft seemed to be identifying the ship as belonging to their ally, America.
There were about 9 different occasions that airplanes came out, and probably 12 times that were circled, 12 separate orbits of the ship during the morning.
Lloyd Painter relieved Ennis as officer of the deck. He too was reassured by the presence of the Israeli planes.
I remember vividly looking out through the portholes, looking down on the 01 level, and seeing all the officers sunbathing. And at the same time, we were being overflown, and I remember feeling very good and very warm inside that we were safe. They knew who we were. We were not a stranger out there that day.
Confident that the Israelis knew who they were, the Liberty men relaxed. A new flag was flying, visibility was perfect, and they'd received no orders to leave the area. That sense of security was about to be brutally shattered. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the officers on the bridge spotted three Delta Wing Mirage jets.
I saw them come at us. In fact, I was looking through the porthole when the jets came down and leveled off on us at attack attitude.
To my surprise, there were red flashes under the wings, and missiles, rockets started hitting the ship.
But the portholes were blown out instantly, mine in my chest. The fellow next to me got it in his face. And we all went down on the deck with the force of the concussion from the glass.
The next thing I heard down in my space was a panicky announcement on the loudspeaker 1MC. General quarters, this is no drill. General quarters, ship is under attack. And you hear ping, 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 ping.
The decks above were being shredded. Attempts to send an SOS message failed. The Liberty's frequencies were being jammed.
You'd have to know what frequencies we were going to come up on. To know that, you'd have to know that we were an American ship. If you knew we were an American ship, you knew what frequencies we were going to be on because you knew what the fleet frequencies were. Duh. Hello.
The attackers knew their target, but they were keeping their own identity well hidden.
During the attack, no one saw any markings, and some of the men told me later that they made a special effort to identify them, and they swear that there were no markings, that these airplanes were unmarked.
They took out all of our transmitting antennas, and shortly thereafter deposited napalm on the deck. It appeared to me that it was the intent of the attacker to take out all communications and keep all people off deck so they couldn't reestablish any sort of antennas or communication system. If it was an accident, it was the best planned accident I've ever heard of. The only reason we got the SOS out was because my crazy troops were climbing the antenna string and long wires while they were being shot at.
At the end of the air attack, 8 men were dead and 75 injured. But the worst was yet to come.
We immediately cast off our lines and rushed out. I at least didn't know why. The sea was very calm and a bright day. I think it was around midday, or maybe a little before that, but around midday. And only on the way we were told there was unknown vessel to the south of us, or south west of us, and we sped over in that direction. Very soon we did see a ship, clearly a naval vessel.
The last thing I remember is the captain on the intercom system saying, "Stand by for torpedo attack, starboard side."
Down below the waterline, the men in the engine room got ready to die.
Torpedo's coming in, it's going to open that boiler up, and you're going to die instantly. It's going to be like an atomic bomb, because that cold water, when that cold water hits that boiler, it's operating at full, there's just no hope. So all of us 19-year-olds, the best place to be is right there. You're going to get it. You're going to give it up right then and there. So torpedo attack.
Escapar al cercano oriente, oriente olvidando los, ¿cómo se dice? Commercially exploited miners, y otros represados por OPD. El sujeto del semana pasada, yo soy DJ Mouse, fundador de Bolsheviks Anonymous. Aunque soy mexicano y estoy en México libre, aquí mismo en Yajilán, Bahía de Ishi, todos sabemos Ishi, the last Yahi Ishi, donde hemos abolido esclavitud casi dos siglos aquí. De 1824, 8, something like that. And we could build a wall northeast of Four Corners, but on the Texas shit, don't I get to join the invasion force every time I'm there? I'm looking for the messenger's grave. Hold that thought, Jim, because.
So she was born in 1880 in Texas, as I said, and she and her siblings were the first generation in my family on my father's side of people that had been born out of slavery, the first generation to be free, born free. And I come from a very long line of light-skinned black people dating all the way back from slavery. And so she and her siblings received word that they had been freed. Her parents and their siblings received word that they had been freed on June 19, 1865. that Lincoln had freed the slaves. And word came to the Texas slaves 2.5 years late because it's kind of odd, but the Confederate soldiers had such a presence still in Texas that they kept killing the Union generals as they would come down to give them word that they had been free. And so they got 2.5 more years out of slavery in Texas than in the rest of the country. And so that is how my family learned that they had been freed, and they decided to get the heck out of Texas before there was such a compelling reason. and I think they were headed to Canada, and they stopped along the way, and they got tired and stopped in Nebraska. I know it's happening place at the time, it must have been. And that's how I came to be born and raised in Nebraska. So this is the whole record, the whole brand new CD, Wheatgrass, is kind of about my family's journey northward. So this was called Saskatchewan. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura Love. Well, let's go. I think this is Gerald asking Don Pigler, are you repressed?
Yes, my name is Gerald. Yes, exactly. He is basically a branch of the, you know, I worked with the Longshore Union, and we stopped the partnership that was owned by Israel a couple of years ago. And what I was wondering to see is we have this thing called boycott, you know, boycott investment, sanctions, movement. And here at UC Berkeley, UAW, or the grad students is what they are, passed a resolution supporting this
BDS.
Right. Now, after they passed that, the international UAW leadership, United All Workers leadership, did something rather unusual, and that is they reversed, I don't know how you do that, but they reversed this resolution by this local out here, this grad school teacher local. So that's the atmosphere that's right now, you know, they're being extremely repressive towards students and anybody else that comes out in support of the PBS stuff. So my question to you is, have you experienced repression, mistreatment on the part of the government or the government of Israel for you, basically, educating the American public?
I think that most governments are just waiting for Holocaust survivors to die out. I think that's their solution. However, I think I alluded to the fact that the American Legion at the top level, knuckle center to the powers to be. We had one of our guys who was not for the Alabama Liberty Veterans Association who was killed as a result of losing a little bit of anger at the National American Legion Convention. Eventually the American Legion dropped their complaint, but it turned into a law. I think I related it dinner. I belong to a group called, I guess I choose not to say the name, not that there's anything wrong with it, but one of the members walked up to me after one of the meetings and said, you know, you guys are off the liberty, you just need to shut up about it.
Oh!
So that's a different story from being personally repressed by our own government or the Israeli government. No, I've never had either government come at me. I don't think they want to draw attention. If they draw attention to me, they draw attention to the whole thing, and I don't think that's the last thing they want. So.
Consisted of robbery, killing, and pimping. Filthy rich and the biggest killer that you ever seen. Once I'm older, I'm taking over, I'ma be king. I was locked up in jail when we got the new van. Opened his cells, I guess that's how the story began. First mission was to clear it out and claim it is mine. Indigenous people were peaceful, it took no time. Great-grandmother Africa was blind and disabled. Sons was traitors, we played divide and conquer, invaded. Sold the children into slavery and profited quick. Started making side deals and that's how I got rich. Daddy Britton found out and tried to put me in check. He don't understand I'm a man and I deserve some respect. Try to bring it to me, but I play for keeps and I run. Feel my daddy, but you ain't the only man with a gun. More money, more problems, little brother is wild. They call him the South, he country with a big ass mouth. Try to show him new business, but he don't
wanna change. Love him, but I knew eventually I'd blow out his brains. I'm American.
Welcome to the Triple Vice Condition November edition of Mouse Report. Of course, Condition November is what they declared when they were sending the nukes towards Cairo, and Triple Vice is what JFK was in. Of course, this is less than 4 years after we got our brains blown out, landing on the back of the vehicle. 50 years later, Big Brother is pointing out that the First Lady recovered them from there to hand to the doctor at Parkside after driving past the Patsy that they are trying to rub our noses in. As we, the West, rub the world's nose in our doo-doo, as if a five-year-old doesn't know that after driving past the projectile source, your brains get thrown forward. Obviously shot from in front the grassy knoll where E. Howard Hunt is photographed in a disheveled condition, you know, drug out of boxcars with Sturgis, Frank Sturgis, Gusano, Fiorini, Sturgis, you know, the white Cubanos. Gusano is, almost a say maggot. Never mind. Triple Vice, Condition November and Dirty Dick's Bay of Pigs thing, because Haldeman and the Ends of Power decodes that Watergate smoking gun, June 23rd, 1972. It'll blow the Bay of Pigs thing because this involves Hunt, whose photo overlays and coup d'etat in America show him there on the day. So also on November 21st, there's three vice presidents. Dirty Dick, that's why today's show, Triple Vice, Condition November, and Dirty Dick's Bay of Pigs thing. That's his code to John Dean, who when the, at the Paris Review, he worked under confessed CIA guy, Peter Matheson, and then he had John Dean on. And I asked him, what were they trying to get? Was it the pictures from Dallas? Because that's the Bay of Pigs thing explained in the Ends of Power, and he said, oh, no, it was blah, 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 blah. But really, friends, Babylonians, countrymen, lend me your ears. Unlike Iraqi children born without ears or mouths, we have no excuse for silently accepting denial of responsibility for the million pounds of uranium fed their mothers by pirates of the Potomac and allied slave mongers of the West. Not a location, but a psychotic state, dehumanizing all in our way, marching south through Libya, north through Lebanon, and east through Syria and Iraq, all conveniently located on our post 9/11 hit list, and onward through Tehran and Moscow. And what's that? World War III ahead? Oh, well, let's look behind. Now, that's actually before you. You know, your past is before you. The unseen, you point over your shoulder to. But been there, done that. Here's Don Pagler at Cedar and Benita Saturday night. Thank you.
first of March. Got married. Reported to the Liberty late March. We went to see May the 2nd, and we were attacked June the 8th. So I was about as green as anybody on the ship. I was still trying to figure out how to put one foot in front of the other and keep from falling overboard. But anyway, so from there, I think, go back to tying it. From the basic slideshow, I have added five slides. Three of them are at the beginning and two of them are at the end. So I will start with. Right after the hit is where I slept, my sleeping bag. Department. Now, the crew was divided, two-thirds of the crew were Princess technicians, the other third were deck crew. The deck crew slept the forward part of the ship, and we slept in the aft part of the ship. The other thing that I think is important to point out is there isn't a microwave antenna right here, but this large dish, it looks like a ground station dish, this is 1967. Hughes, who I worked for, we put up our first satellite in the early 60s, but that first satellite is about the size of a footstool. So there really wasn't much traffic being carried by satellites in those days. This was called Crestron, and it stands for Terrestrial Relay Satellite System. And we used this to bounce our signal off and then back to NSA headquarters in Chelten, Maryland. I hope that gives you a basic perspective of what the Liberty was about and what the structure of it was. The Israelis say they came out and they didn't see a flag, which we not only were flying the flag, but during the middle of the attack, it got so shot up that our signal and generators put up our holiday colors, which is a 7x13-foot flag, which is very large flag. I could be wrong, but if I remember right, this number 5, I think, was 30 feet tall. So how they pick a mistake that ship or anything but an American ship is a little unlikely to see. I had just worked the mid watch from midnight to 8 in the morning, got off with my mid watch, went to the mess deck, ate breakfast, went into my sleeping compartment, and went to bed. So I took the wrap, which was the Navy, which was the bed. And at 1 o'clock, Captain Nagel ordered to General Quarters Drill. Well, fortunately for me, my general quarters station had to be on the mess deck right forward where I was sleeping, so I got dressed. And when I was in the mess deck, I was assigned to repair part 3, and I was supposed to be in charge of the submergible pump. So about 1:35, 1:40, we secured from the drill. I was off duty, so I went out with some of the other guys to the fan, you know, the aft part of the ship. I went to smoke cigarettes and relax a little bit. I had just decided to go back down into my sleeping compartment, was halfway down the ladder when I heard all the metal hitting and the general quarters alarm sounded again, and that's when the attack started at 2 o'clock. So I just went on down the ladder through my compartment under the mess deck. As I said, I was so green I didn't have a clue what to do. Obviously, during an air attack, there was no need for a submergible pump. So somebody with experience would have me instead go to the bridge and bring down a wounded. So I and I felt crawled up the superstructure there, which you saw the bridge of it, which was the safest way to get up there in the inside part of the ship. And just as we got up there, somebody threw open the hatch and we had a guy on the stretcher, and we all got down below about 3 or 4 sets of ladders, which is a little difficult carrying a guy on the stretcher down 3 or 4 sets of ladders. Navy ship ladders are very steep. And I had, as I told somebody in Arizona last month, for most of us, we usually think of our past like a movie. I mean, you don't remember every specific detail that went on every second, but you have the general idea of how you spent your time. For me, my memory of the attack is a lot like a bunch of pictures that I try to fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So out of the 25-30 minutes of the air attack, I don't remember how many rounds I dig up and down with the bridge. The next thing I remember was they said And then they came out and made torpedo guns, fired torpedoes at us, and before that they came out with bombers and dropped napalm on us, so we were trying to fight the fires from the napalm while they were bringing out the torpedo guns. All we had for our own, as I said before, was 450 caliber machine guns, two up on the front, so like two of the inches. I have some slides that will show you how undermanned we were. So, as I said, we let Marlow go next second. We got to head, our normal room is up and down the west coast of Africa. We got to Abidjan, which is the capital of the Ivory Coast. Make that up, I don't remember exactly whether it was the 28th, whatever, within a few days. And we were supposed to have 4.5 days delivered. That got cut short, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We turned on the way down in the Atlantic on the top. Believe it or not, I was skinny. That was me, 21 years old. The bottom pictures are when we hit Abidjan. Those are taken at a hotel called the Hotel of Law. Fortunately, this audience is old enough to understand this. My understanding is the hotel was owned by Van Hammond. I give this talk to high school kids, and they look at me like, what's a Van Hammond?
Light airline.
But anyway, so as I said, we were supposed to have 4.5 days of liberty. After a day and a half, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had taken direct control of the liberty and ordered us to go into the Mediterranean because they knew things were heating up. Since they weren't started yet, they knew that things would get hot and heavy. So they ordered us to go to Spain, and said we would receive further orders once we got to Rota, Spain. So this is when we got to Rota. He did have to be my camera, although the one on the bottom right, obviously I didn't take the picture because I'm in the picture. That is a photo that the Navy was not that happy that I had. The reason being is Rota is a submarine base, and across the channel behind me is a sub-tender. But if you look right down in front of it, right there, is a nuclear fast attack submarine, and the Navy does not like having their Nikki Sos photographed. This many years later, I don't think anybody's going to come after me, but then we were told to head into the Mediterranean. We were going to be stationed between 12 and 15 miles off the Gaza Strip. Sinai Peninsula, and we got there a couple of days before the attack, and we were trolling along at 5 knots. These pictures are taken before the attack. This is our executive officer, Bill Armstrong. He is an academy graduate. This is also Armstrong. And to his right is one of my crypto chiefs, Chief Smith. Both of them died during the attack. There is a school building in Pensacola where I was trained, named after Chief Smith now. These are three of our top officers. Sunbathing about 3 or 4 hours before we were attacked. This is Armstrong. In the back is Lieutenant Golden. Lieutenant Golden was what we call a Mustang officer, an LDO, limited duty officer, which means he was enlisted and then promoted into the officer rank. George had two ships shot out from underground during World War II, so needless to say, after the liberty, he became a very religious person. On the right is Captain McGonigal, who was just exactly twice my age. He was 42. In the morning, the Israelis had run between 9 and 13 reconnaissance missions on the same morning. They even admitted that they had identified as an American intelligence ship on their control board in Haifa. that they said, well, it's just at 8 o'clock after the shift change, and they took the marker off the board because it's all the information. So this is one of the recon planes that was earlier in the morning. This is the first attack aircraft coming in at 2 o'clock. Then down below this picture of me with two of the 800 rocket pools. This is Captain Geigel on the bridge looking at a rock and roll. Ensign Lucas with two of the rock and rolls. This picture was taken in a similar place to the one of me. His name is sort of Peter, one of my CPs. Both of us in Missouri there. Again, more rock and rolls. In the background, you can see the press conference antenna. The reason that I don't have any trouble talking about the press conference antenna is I got on the web about a year ago, and it's all over the web. I mean, it's obviously declassified. But the rest of this is all still just damage. Here I was at the aft end of the ship looking forward. So this is the starboard side of the bridge with three rock and holes. Down here is where our whaleboat, our captain's gig, it burnt from fire. This picture kind of shows the overall part of the ship, and it shows how full of holes they were. That picture actually ended up in Life magazine in the July edition. However, the whole spread of the July edition was about what the Israelis were doing with the Six-Day War. The front cover had an Israeli army guy holding an AK-47. It said very little about what happened to us. Again, more rock and rolls. So as you saw in that beginning slide, this is the bridge area up here. That's the flying bridge. Down here, this is one of our antenna mounts, but there's another picture that has more of them, and I'll talk to that. Where this dark is up here, it looks like it might possibly be burnt. It's actually a tank that's been chipped off by a machine gun. So, I took these pictures, the first one on the left, looking forward at the postal. Now, Jim Ennis, who wrote Assault on the Liberty, said he looked forward and saw one of our gunner's mates get hit by a rocket and flew in the air like a rag doll end over end. Well, I'm sure that what he was talking about was this forward starboard gun there, and Alexander Thompson, the Arthur class gunner's mate, who was in that mount. And what's left with Thompson, you see the blood of Thompson running down this bulkhead here. The Israelis have tried to say we fired back at them, and in fact, we probably did fire less than 10 rounds. One of my shipmates who died a few years ago, lived in Nebraska, his name is Dale Larkin, said that after Thompson was blown out of the gun mount, McGonigal sent him forward, and he went up there, and he said he got in the gun mount, and he said the belt had been broken, and only about two or three rounds had been fired. He said he rethreaded the belt, tried to fire the gun, and he said he got off a few rounds and the gun jammed. So nobody really got off that many rounds. Then I went up onto the postal, like over in this area, on the port side, looking into that gun mount. And these are pictures taken the following day. We didn't see any Americans till the following day, and I'll talk about that later. But this USS Davis is sailing alongside of us. To give you an idea of how undermanned we were, in the background here, that is the Davis's anti-aircraft gun. Down here is our little 50 caliber two shooter. So we didn't have, pardon the expression, small chance in hell of being able to fight off fighter jets. These are cabin photos. The Proctor hole is just a cabin dynamo right there. It's a rock and roll underneath the porthole. This picture here is in Lieutenant Golden's cabin looking out of the rock and roll in this cabin. This is our main mast. It had a rock and roll in it, although it's kind of hard to see in the slide. That's the forward port gun mount, opposite of where Thompson was. These are our antenna mounts. The Israelis were using heat-sinking missiles. So they immediately took out all our antennas because antennas are getting a lot of heat. And fortunately, we had one antenna that was down for repairs and wasn't emitting any heat. So their rockets didn't destroy that one. One of my shipmates that I've become close to, especially after my wife died, every time I come up to see Linda, I would stop and stay in Visalia and carry them in Visalia. Unfortunately, Kerry died a year and a half ago of a heart attack. Kerry went out and strung a line from the transmitting shack out to the antenna that was damaged. And that's how we got our distress call out at 205. So, 5 years ago, Terry was given the Silver Star because nobody really had realized what he had done. Copy of the Silver Star is back on the table. His Silver Star is the first document that says that it was the Israelis that attacked us. My presidential unit citation, Captain McGonigal's Medal of Honor, all say we were attacked by foreign jet aircraft and computer guns. Never mentions the Israelis. Fortunately, I guess the pro-Israeli people in this country were switching with me. The terrorists, Silver Star, and so they got it in there that it was the Israelis that attacked us. I've been working with a fellow in Australia. We're trying to get Junaid's name, the U.S.'s by the city and county of Florida, named it U.S.'s Liberty and Terry Albarnia to remember this. But you can see how they knew exactly what they were doing. This is more damage, but the interesting thing about this is on the port side. This side that we were looking at at the beginning of that. And this rocket came in the starboard side of the ship. The other side of the ship passed clear through the ship and came out on this side. The reason you can tell that is you see the metal one is going out. So, as I said earlier, after all the rocket damage and everything that came out of bombers and not napalm bombers, and while we're trying to fight the fires from the napalm, they brought out three, maybe torpedoes and fired five torpedoes at us. Two things that I was about to mention about this slide. One is, this is 171, is with. Now it's 174. We had three guys apply for and receive Purple Hearts since that time. It takes a certain amount of documentation. They have to have people that can testify to the fact that they saw their wounds, etc. We have one doctor and two corpsmen for 280 guys that received Purple Hearts. So you can imagine what their job was like. As I said, the Nicky Mac bombers and not napalm miles. This is from napalm damage. I took these photos starting here at the bottom left. That is an inflatable life raft. They're obviously not particularly all burned. If you look here, this is where that rack attaches to the bulkhead, and you can see where the bulkhead's all charred and fire. Then I took a picture looking upward, and that's where that same attachment is. And then I went up on the next deck and took a picture looking into the gun nest. mind stopped. It's all fire image. Again, our first sound engine in the background. So, we have most of the way we'll talk about the third top slide. That's Captain McGonigal and Lieutenant Painter. Lieutenant Painter, like me, got out of the Navy after 4 years. He became a Secret Service agent. For years, he was, he lived in Fairfield over here, and I was assigned to the San Francisco Secret Service Office. As I said, we had all the really bad men women on the nest eggs. This is a good place to pick up. After the air attack, I remember somebody, and they said, prepare for, when Captain Gallo came on, said, prepare for a torpedo attack. Somebody said, throw yourself across the wounded. So we did that, and it was a good thing somebody had experience enough to say that, because when we took the torpedo, it was like a giant was on one side of the ship, just lifted it up. Being at the aft end of the ship, it just sounded like a thud to me. Lifted the ship up in the air, and then we just slowly sank back down in the water, but if somebody had told us to do that, all those guys would have rolled off the floor onto the deck. So it's a good thing that we had some experience on it. This guy here has been in and out of the VA hospital all his life. He lives in McLean, Maryland now. One of the few little levity points in the presentation is that guy was one of my crypto guys. His name was William Blossom. He lived in Colorado. He's dead now. If you take a look at his nose, I don't have one myself, but his nickname was Bullwinkle, for any of you that remember the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. And if you look right behind him is a guy with glasses on. I have a picture, unfortunately, I didn't put it in the slideshow. Ken lives in Illinois. Ken was the next day was holding his helmet, his battle helmet. They had two or three holes about this size. He decided to tell him, so why Ken's still alive? I don't think anybody understands. So, again, I'm talking about 99 topside from the internet. When we took the torpedo hit, where I worked up forward, 25 guys died down where I worked. After we took the torpedo, well, the other thing I remember during the torpedo attack was one of my shipmates was on his knees on the deck and with his rosary beads saying goodbye to life. And then somebody said, take the submersible pump forward to the torpedo's faces. And all I remember is I got up there just in time, and one of the officers was making the decision to close the hatch to make the ship watertight so we didn't sink. And the other thing I remember thinking is, man, I'm glad I'm not here. I'm having to make that decision and have to live with that the rest of my life and wonder whether there's anybody left down there alive. So, I will get into why we can get any help a little later, but this slide talks to the fact that our engines went totally offline when we finally got them restarted and turned out to sea. We sailed the ship for a week, 1,000 miles across the Mediterranean, driven right out of Malta. One of the questions a lot of people ask is, why didn't they send it to the creek, which wasn't their star? And I can't answer it. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the creek didn't have dry dock facilities like Malta did. Anyway. So this is one of the Israeli torpedo boats circling us. Now, as I said, the air attack lasted to 125-130. We took the torpedo around 135-140. After a while, the torpedo boats sort of backed off, but then we threw our last few inflatable life rafts in the water, and the torpedo boats came along, and machine gun holds in the life rafts, which is a violation of the Virginia if they mentioned you being a citizen from saving their own life. This is what we call case sharding. It's the way we kept the ship afloat, which a lot of people can't believe we did manage to keep her afloat. As a matter of fact, I ran into a kid in 2007 who was studying like a boot camp, and he said they used the Liberty to teach damage control in boot camp. These were like railroad type pieces of timber. Because the internal bulkhead is not strong enough to withstand all that sea pressure. One of the things they did with me that night after the attack was, this was a day or two later, and they cleaned it up. They took me up there, it was full of fuel oil, gave me a little one battery flashlight, said, here, watch this timber and make sure it doesn't get away. So I stood a 4-hour meeting up there doing that. I will talk a little later about the Davis and the Massey and the American, which we didn't see until the following day. One of the other duties that I went out of the 6 days, the only other thing I really remember is they took me down to the bottom of the ship in what we call Shaft Alley, which is where the dry shaft went from the engine room back to the screw, and said, gave me a set of headphones and said, here, watch this. Because if we go any faster than 5 knots, the ship starts to shake, and if things start to leak down here, you call the bridge and tell them we have to abandon the ship. And the other thing I remember thinking was, that's great, you guys might get off of here, but I'm going to be stuck down in the bottom of this thing. And as I said on a radio interview, that when you're the little man on the totem pole, that's the kind of duty you get. So these pictures I took the following morning, as the Davis and the Massey came closer and closer. And one of the excuses, well, a number of different things, one of the excuses the Israelis used was that they came out to find the ship shell on the shore the day before. And also that they came out, they thought they had us on a radar going 30 knots. Well, we were converted to World War II partnership. The top speed of the Liberty was 18 knots. Then they said they mistook us for an Egyptian ship called the Al-Jazeera, which is actually, even the Mossad knew at the time, was in dry dock in Alexandria, Egypt, and wasn't even seaworthy. It was a World War I horse carrier that the English built that had been sold to the Egyptians. And it was 1/4 of the displacement of the river, so it wasn't even near the same size. So the other thing is, they said they came out trying to ship the shell on the shore the day before. Now, when I went through PTSD, when I confronted with my anger, which was totally intact as a reason for the high blood pressure, and then again, one of the guys that had been a Marine in Vietnam looked at me and said, you know, you guys got screwed as bad as up, or seen anybody ever knew in Vietnam. He said, you got every right to be as angry as you can be, but he said, I tell you, in order to get rid of my anger, transferred this to me to make sure it's safe. They had a 5-inch gun on their ship, and if we'd had a 5-inch gun, maybe we'd have shown the shore. I'm not even sure then, but certainly not with our little stinking 50 caliber machine guns. This is also the next day, and the Davis is sailing alongside of us. These are pictures of guys on the America taking pictures with Iceland and back then. We had this helicopter pilot off the America, one of my shipmates, that's a radio show. So we didn't see, as I said, any Americans come in the morning, the days of the Nancy, then in the afternoon, the America came alongside. And we evacuated the badly wounded. And so this is the helicopter pilot. He couldn't sit down on our coastal or I wasn't in that room, so he just did his landing gear down on the first, put the stretchers on it, and this is him returning to the America. And these are the guys on the America unloading our wounded. Now I'll talk about what was his plea to earlier, Johnson ordered his plea to abandons. Dave Lewis was my boss. He was lieutenant commander at the time. He was in charge of all of our intelligence group. Dave also happened to be an academy graduate. And Dave was taken from the torpedo. He said he went to